Make sure you're serious. Cause it can be dangerous. Yes, it's not a joke thing, no. Don't you hustle in the name of the fella. That can be dangerous. Make sure you're serious.
Now the members, so we are going to meet them at the gate and I see it.
No. When you say you love, make sure it's from your heart. All your life disguising, know that one day you'll be caught. So when you're planning to brainwash your brother, that can be serious. That can be dangerous, but it's not a joke thing, no. And when you come as the devil's disciple and spread your evil over the people, it's not a joke thing, no. Brother man, that's from today. Make sure of what you say. Don't you watch the crowd. My father is not loud. So when you call on the name of my father, make sure you're serious. It can be dangerous. Oh, it's not a joke thing. No, no.
Play that tune one more time next week. You know, see, because that song has been listening to the lyrics, not the song, not the beat. The lyrics, very serious. You know, see,
it's not a joke.
After hours, right here, take over.
There is this thing. Do you realize what is? There is this thing. Do you realize
consciousness is affected?
There is this thing. On. There is this thing going on. Do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called
the news? I'm brought to you live.
Good afternoon and welcome to the Prison Radio Show here on SKUT 90.3 FM. My name is Candace.
And my name is Yasmin.
And we'll be your hosts for today's show. Today on the program, we are highlighting International Women's Day. So it is March 8th, as well as the Week Against Police Brutality that kicks off tomorrow and culminates with the International Day Against Police Brutality on March 15th. But first, here are some news headlines.
According to itsgoingdown.org, a grand jury has indicted Scott Daniel Warren, a volunteer with the organization No More Deaths, No Más Muertes, with three felony charges, two counts of felony harboring and one charge of felony conspiracy. The maximum sentence for these charges is 20 years in prison. The new conspiracy charge is notable, as conspiracy charges have been used by the government to scare and suppress social justice movements and target political dissidents. This case holds critical weight as the Trump administration targets immigrant rights leaders and those who stand with them nationwide. No More Deaths is an organization committed to resisting this troubling trend in enforcement and continue our work of ending death and suffering in the borderlands.
Also, according to It's Going Down, one of our favorite websites, the trial has concluded for the Black Pride 4 protesters who, alongside Black, Queer, and Intersectional Columbus, and in solidarity with No Justice, No Pride, they took direct action on June 17th of last year to disrupt the Pride Parade in Columbus, Ohio. It's the second largest Pride celebration in the Midwest. The direct action by the Black Pride 4 sought to draw attention to the violence against and the erasure of Black and Brown queer and trans people, in particular the lack of space for Black and Brown people at Pride festivals. And also, their action was to highlight the disproportionately high number of trans women of color that have been murdered last year. So for peacefully protesting police violence in Columbus, a city whose police killed at least 28 people, 21 of whom are Black, since 2013, the four, Ripley Bennett, Kendall Denton, Ashley Braxton, and DeAndre Antonio Miles Hercules, were arrested on charges including aggravated robbery, resisting arrest, causing harm to a police officer, failure to comply with a police officer's order, and disorderly conduct. Bail was originally set at $100,000. So this last month, on Monday, February 12th, a jury convicted three of the members of the Black Pride 4 on six of eight misdemeanor counts. Ripley Bennett was convicted of disorderly conduct, failure to comply with a police officer's orders, and resisting arrest. Ashley Braxton, of disorderly conduct and failure to comply, and Kendall Denton of disorderly conduct. Sentencing is expected in coming weeks. The fourth protester, DeAndre Miles, faces a felony charge of aggravated robbery and will be tried separately. Miles has been accused of reaching for a police officer's gun during the incident. The Black Pride 4 took action to draw attention to the violence and erasure of Black and Brown trans and queer folks within LGBTQ spaces. The fact that their actions were met with criminalization, violence, and laughter from white onlookers is a testament to the urgency of their message. Like Marsha P. Johnson and Sylvia Rivera before them, the Black Pride 4 are the latest in the trans and queer tradition of those who are most vulnerable and marginalized within our communities, putting themselves on the line in pursuit of liberation for us all.
Our next piece of news comes to us from Reuters. Britain has announced to build a new wing at the Kirikiri prison in the Nigerian city of Lagos so that it can transfer Nigerian prisoners there. The London government announced plans for a new 112-bed wing, which will cost £700,000, which is equivalent to $973,000, and be compliant with United Nations standards, and which will make it easier for Britain to comply with the prisoner transfer agreement it signed with Nigeria in 2014. Under that deal, eligible prisoners serving criminal sentences in Nigeria and Britain can be returned to complete their sentences in their respective countries. The British government did not indicate how many prisoners might be moved or when the project is likely to be completed. Nigerian prisons, many of them built by British colonizers more than 100 years ago, are severely overcrowded, leading to the spread of diseases. The government in Abuja has said it is developing a strategy to tackle the issue. Britain's own prison system has been showing signs of severe strain in recent years, with overcrowding, rising suicide rates, and a growing problem with drug trafficking and other crimes within jails that were sometimes built in the Victorian era. Kirikiri is not one of the oldest prisons in Nigeria, but it does date back to colonial times. Last month, the government said the prison in the southern city port of Harcourt, which was originally designed to hold 800 prisoners, currently has nearly 5,000. It said 3,700 of them had been awaiting trial for more than 5 years. In a written statement to Parliament, British Foreign Secretary Boris Johnson said tenders had been placed and a supplier identified to conduct the building work at Kirikiri. He did not name the supplier. The project will be funded of more than £1 billion and aims to commission projects that can help to prevent conflicts and stabilize countries or regions.
The Santa Maria Sun reports that in the early morning hours of March 4th, Lompoc Federal Correctional Institution staff discovered that a prisoner had walked away from a satellite prison camp in Lompoc, which is located in California. Mauricio Martinez was serving time at the prison for dealing meth and is still at large at the time of this report. The U.S. Marshals Service and other law enforcement agencies were notified of Martinez's disappearance that day, according to the Federal Bureau of Prisons, and an internal investigation was initiated. Martinez is the second prisoner to walk out of the minimum security prison this year. Inmate Carl Henderson also walked out of the satellite prison camp in January. Four inmates escaped from the prison last year, and five people did the same in 2016. According to Lompoc Police Department, the standard procedure following a walkout is to post an image and information about the inmate on the department's mobile app. Community members are also encouraged to report any sightings of suspected escapees, but sightings aren't common, says the police department. The sergeant says, our experience has been, in all the years that I've been here at the department, that by the time we're notified, they are completely out of the area. We keep our eyes open, and if we see them, we deal with them. But more than likely, that's not going to happen. And next on the program here on the Prison Radio Show, we bring you some commentaries from Critical Resistance. Critical Resistance is a network which seeks to build an international member-led and member-run grassroots movement and the prison industrial complex. They wish to challenge the belief that caging and controlling people makes us safe. Critical Resistance believes that it is not punishment which cures complicated social problems, but rather that basic necessities such as food, shelter, and freedom are what make our communities secure. So we are going to hear four commentaries produced by Critical Resistance, including the voices of Laura Whitehorn, who is a formerly incarcerated political prisoner and organizer with the New York-based Release Aging People in Prison. We are going to hear from Maya Chenoir, who is the editor-in-chief of Truth Out and also the author of Locked Down, Locked Out, Why Prison Doesn't Work and How We Can Do Better. We are going to hear from Alice Kim, an Illinois-based organizer who is involved in the Prison Neighborhood Arts Project. And we are also going to hear from Andrea Ritchie. Andrea Ritchie is the author of Invisible No More, Police Violence Against Black Women and Women of Color. Andrea Ritchie is going to be speaking here in Montreal next week.
The time is presently 5:11. You're listening to the Prison Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM, 91.7 on cable, and www.ckut.ca.
People of color are locked up, and people think about that a lot of times as sort of an aspect of racism. That's true. But there's an impact of it on the ability of communities to continue to struggle. So I think you see the rise of, I've heard people talk about the rise of mass incarceration starting in the 70s, right? Well, what else happened in the 70s? There was the destruction of the Black Power movement, the Puerto Rican independence movement inside the United States, the Native American movement, and the white anti-imperialist movement, less so the latter, but mostly the Black movement and the Puerto Rican movement, by COINTELPRO and by the FBI and by the law enforcement agencies, not just the FBI, but the militarization of police. You can see that all starting at the same time. And so when you see the mass incarceration of especially Black youth, who are those people? Those are the people who 10 or 15 years before were the people who made up the Black Panther Party, the Revolutionary Action Movement, the Detroit League of Revolutionary Black Workers, and other and the African Liberation Day movement. So all of those resistant forms were populated and created by Black people. So if you take the masses of Black people and you not only incarcerate many of them for all these advanced crimes that weren't crimes before and with long sentences that weren't long sentences before, then you can disempower the community in that way. In addition, you disempower their families, because now, in addition to having to struggle to make a living, their mothers, their sisters, their fathers, their kids have to struggle to keep those people in commissary, to schlep miles and miles and miles to see them, and to hold on to their homes. So in New York City, if you travel around, as I did when I got out of prison in the end of 1999, I was really appalled by what had happened to the neighborhoods that I remembered as vibrant, not rich, but vibrant, sustained Black working class neighborhoods that were now decimated. And the government was saying, oh, it's drugs. No, it's mass incarceration. You can see where in every neighborhood that fed the prison system with thousands of kids and adults who were incarcerated, the housing stock was destroyed and turned now into into big apartment complexes for rich white people. You can see that all over. You also see the impact on the schools, because when the schools became police institutions, where when you walk into a school, a public school in New York City, it's like walking into a prison. I mean, one time I went to speak in my friend Dequy's class in an arts high school in Midtown, and it was the first time I had been in a high school since I got out of prison. And I really had flashbacks, because you had to go through two security checks and a metal detector. And then there's this desk of cops, you know, hanging out, drinking coffee and laughing with each other. And I felt like I was in prison again. It was just like the cop station in every unit of every prison I was ever in. So when you turn the schools into places where kids are brought to jail for being late to class, which was happening in New York City for many years, you've destroyed education. So I see all of those. And then you see that the ideology that was pushed on the masses of people, which was believed broadly that crime was limited and that we needed more laws, and every time someone would commit a crime, there would be a new law in New York State and other places. We have sex offender laws now that mean if you commit a crime, a violent crime, in a place where there is a child, even if the child is like half a mile away from you, they're in the same location, you are automatically forever a sex offender. I mean, it had nothing to do with sex, just a child present. And so the expansion of all those laws then created a consciousness among people that we need more laws, more laws, more lock them up, and that what was going on was actually something to protect people rather than something to destroy resistance to injustice.
She's in jail right now, and her public defender was saying, well, she won't be able to get probation because she's already had probation, and they won't give you probation on multiple occasions because that demonstrates that it hasn't worked for you, and so she'll probably go to prison. And I said, well, she's already served 6 jail and prison sentences, like, can't we look at prison as a thing that hasn't worked for her? And he was just like, you are ridiculous. You know, he then wanted to get off the phone. And I thought, well, you know, part of it is that's not like in the toolkit for public defenders or any lawyers really, but most lawyers. But also, it grated against the terms of the system. You know, that question was like deeply disturbing for him to hear, because it was like, well, what else is there? You know, that's impossible. That's not a thing that's within the range of my job, but also within the range of the system that I've been taught to operate within. And I think that that's been kind of the story of my family's interaction with the system. And kind of on a small scale, I've seen how every time my sister goes to prison, she kind of becomes more and more caged and more entangled in the complex. And that includes the experiences she's had being locked up in treatment centers. That includes her experience being locked up in electronic monitoring when she couldn't go to the grocery store or take her daughter to the park. And that also includes the way in which my niece has had to go into foster care and be disconnected from her family and trapped in a space that she can't get out of, which is another kind of room in the complex, you know, and she's continuing to be punished and also surveilled by DCFS, Child Protective Services here in Illinois, just right alongside her mother, you know. So all kinds of people are getting entangled. And I think one of the ways in which I've felt like journalism and writing can be helpful here is kind of telling the stories of those entanglements.
Avalon Blue presents an evening of poetry and song featuring some of Montreal's finest independent talent. The ambience of the Café Osmo will set the scene for an intimate and interactive concert. Centrally located at 51 Sherbrooke Street West, near the intersection of Saint Laurent and Sherbrooke, the event is only a hop and a skip away. For a suggested donation of $7, you will be immersed in reflective poetry, fun pop music, and good vibes. Featuring performances by Avalon Blue, Bright, and other special guests, you are sure to make memories and meet someone new. The event takes place on Friday, March 23rd. The music will get underway early at 9 p.m. A CKUT co-presentation.
There's this question of being a prison abolitionist. And, you know, for a long time I had considered myself a prison abolitionist, and I still consider myself a prison abolitionist. But I think that what that means and what that has meant for me has really changed. And I think that that is because of, you know, the experiences of, you know, organizing against the death penalty, trying to get people who are innocent, you know, out of prison, off of death row, trying to, you know, do that kind of work, you know, and then also trying to, I think, shine a light on those who are responsible for wrongful convictions. For example, here in Chicago, we have the example of former Commander John Burge, who was responsible for a torture ring of white police officers who essentially tortured over 100, at least 117 African-American men. And, you know, we had very much, you know, it's been just a really, really long struggle. And many of us were calling for his prosecution. And I think you see that with a lot of the high-profile cases of police violence today, that people are calling for the prosecution of the police officers involved. And, you know, I really see the contradiction that people, you know, people who are the victims of Burge and company ended up spending, you know, many long years incarcerated based on coerced confessions, and then yet the officers involved don't get prosecuted, and even if they are prosecuted, they do not tend to get convicted. So there's an absolute contradiction there that does need to be exposed. But I have found that, you know, prison abolition, you know, it, we really need to rethink the entire system. So to use the same system, the same criminal legal system that is so corrupt, racist, and so on and so forth, to try to solve the problems, I think it's become clear to me that it doesn't really offer a solution, or the kind of solution that I think that our society needs. So for me, I feel like there's been I've been able to shift. What does it mean for me to be a prison abolitionist, and to see that there, you know, we are in desperate need of alternatives to looking to the criminal legal system to provide the solutions that we're seeing.
Took away our dead time. Now we're doing one for one. Sitting in a Supermax, waiting for the judge to come. Without dead time, we spend so much time in jail. I could be here forever if I don't get some bail. I got the dead time blues. Nothing to win, everything to lose. I came in here butt naked. Forensics took my clothes. The summertime was gone. You know I almost froze. Treat me mean. Treat me like a fool. The screws think it's funny. I think it's cruel. I got the dead time blues. Nothing to win. Everything to lose. Maybe I was wrong for being in that room. But the way that they treat us is criminal too. And maybe I was wrong for feeling that way. But the way treat us makes me want to say,
this is the challenge we've been facing for a long time, right? I feel like there's been tremendous work done by groups like Creative Intervention and the Storytelling Organizing Project of giving us examples in which people have addressed harm without the prison industrial complex to varying degrees with success around also not reproducing the values, the prison industrial complex, right? But how to then move it from those individual cases, often within activist communities, often dealing with harm perpetrated by people that we know, who we can bring in people that they know to hold them accountable. I mean, I don't want to undermine the successes of those. Those have been huge, and they offer us a glimpse into what is possible. How to scale those things up into, you know, the alternative 911 that you call anywhere in the country, is like, it feels like there's a chasm between those two things that I have no concept of how to bridge. The only thing I can propose is that it be central to all of our conversations, that we exercise some discipline in saying, if I'm going to talk about, anything to do with state violence, or anything to do with violence generally, I have to then, as part of that conversation, be thinking about what is the response to harm that I'm trying to bring forth as part of that conversation, and what can I contribute towards building it. And that's a discipline I have to exercise, because often I've said, my lane is showing the harms of this approach and showing how those are harms, particularly that women, queer, and trans people experience. Because I feel like, in some ways, we, and still, Jeff Sessions still is like, the one thing I'm going to do for LGBT people is prosecute the shit out of whoever hurts them if it serves my agenda, right? Like, so, in many ways, law and order agendas are built on the backs of violence against women and queer and trans people. So one, I'm like, hey, so this approach doesn't really protect queer and trans people. Let's, here's a whole bunch of incidents of violence that prove that. And I've sometimes, often, including now, I've been content to say, like, and that's my lane. Someone else's job, someone more visionary's job, is to figure out what the alternative is. And I have to exercise the discipline of saying, actually, that's also part of my job. How that turns into infrastructure, I think I just have to trust the process that at some point that conversation will become frequent enough and integrated enough into our broader conversations about the society we want to build that then the energy will come that will then help us figure out what the institutions, what the scaling up of that looks like. I do feel like the number one question I'm asked anytime I sort of put forward an agenda around challenging criminalization and challenging police and criminal legal responses to any number of things, poverty, harm, you know, mental health crisis, domestic violence, sexual violence, et cetera. People are like, great, what's the alternative? And I feel like, on the one hand, I'm like, it's not just my job to answer it. You think about that too, but also it is part of my job to answer it. And that's what we need to talk about. I feel like, also, the models that we were just talking about, they, like I said, they're limited to kind of within activist movement, within communities we know. I feel like we really need to challenge ourselves about, like, what do we do around stranger violence, right? Like, I feel like on the one hand, like, black trans women are really pushing us to be like, look, we know who's killing black trans women. It's black not trans men. And so, as a black community, our responsibility is to figure out how we're going to have those conversations so we can stop this epidemic of fatal violence and other kinds of violence against black trans women. And that has to happen before you start telling us not to pursue hate crimes legislation or hate crimes penalties, right? And so, I feel like that needs to happen. But then also, there are times when it's a stranger and someone who there is no alternate means of accountability. Sometimes it's a cop. They're not interested in community accountabilities. Processes, right? So then what's the answer there? And I feel like those conversations are just ones we need to be having. It's too easy to avoid them. And if we just start having them every time we have the conversation and stop doing what I've been doing, which is deflect that onto some other visionary, imaginary person who's supposed to come up with that answer, then maybe we'll get farther.
That was Andrea Ritchie here on the Prison Radio Show. She was speaking about building alternatives is everyone's job, and she is going to be speaking in Montreal a couple of times on Monday, March 12th at noon. She's going to be speaking on racial profiling, police violence in Canada and the United States. The event is taking place at Reggie's Bar, Solidarity Co-op, which is located at Concordia, 1455 de Maisonneuve West, H231, so in the Hall building. Andrea Ritchie is the author of Invisible No More, Police Violence Against Black Women and Women of Color, and co-author of Say Her Name, Resisting Police Violence Against Black Women and Queer Injustice, the Criminalization of LGBT People in the United States. She's going to be speaking alongside Robin Maynard, who we are going to hear from shortly here on the Prison Radio Show, but also just wanted to let you know, too, that we heard some music. Last up was Faith Nolan with Detention Order Blues. We also heard a couple of other pieces by Critical Resistance. We heard Alice Kim on Rethinking the Entire System, Maya Chenoir, Jail Hasn't Worked for My Sister, and Laura Whitehorn on The Impacts of the Prison Industrial Complex.
We have another song coming up, and this song was introduced to the Miswasining Nagamadruid Swamp Singers by the Odoming Kwe Singers. Nancy Stevens reminds those who sing it that the strong women's song should be credited to the Anishinaabe Kwewag and the Zoganash Kwewag, who were in solitary confinement in the prison for women, P4W, in Kingston, Ontario, during the 1970s. Nancy said it was these women who had this song come to them. My understanding from one of the women I sing with and who went to P4W to work with the women there at the time is that this song emerged as a way of staying alive, of supporting each other in that hellhole. Many women in P4W lost their lives because of the horrendous conditions there. We sing this song to honor them and all women.
Still listening to the Prison Radio Show here on CKUT 90.3 FM at 5:36 p.m. Next on the show, we are going to hear a short clip by Robin Maynard, who is speaking to the themes of her book, Policing Black Lives, State Violence in Canada from Slavery to the Present, which was published by Fernwood last year. Robin Maynard is no stranger to CKUT. She is a Black feminist who has spent years documenting racist and gender-based state violence. She has spent the better part of the decade doing frontline harm reduction outreach work in Montreal and continues to provide trainings for health and social service providers on the harms created by systemic racism, criminal laws, and stigmatization. And she is going to be speaking on Monday, March 12th at noon at Reggie's Bar Solidarity Co-op at Concordia. The event is free, it's wheelchair accessible, and Whisper translation will also be available in French by request.
In 2015, Andrew Loku, a Sudanese father of four, was killed by the police in Toronto in the midst of a mental health crisis. In 2016, Bonnie Jean-Pierre, a Haitian man in his 40s, was killed by the police in Montreal while he was unarmed. In that same year, Abdirahman Abdi was beaten to death by the police in Ottawa. In 2017, Pierre Coriolan was killed by the Montreal police in the midst of a mental health crisis. The deaths of Kilem Registre, the death of Germaine Carby, the death of Anthony Griffin, of Marcellus Francois, the list goes on. We can also look at the death of Black trans woman Shivrana Abdi, who was a Somali woman who was actually dragged face first down the stairs by the police and died in Ontario in 2003. These deaths are part of a national crisis, and they tell a story of the surveillance, punishment, criminalization, and brutalization of Black peoples across Canada. Policing Black Lives tells these stories. The story actually dates back centuries to the practice of slavery that lasted over 200 years on the Indigenous lands that we now call Canada. The criminalization of Black people's lives has always been a major part of policing in Canada. Policing has always been extremely racialized. We can look, for example, to the RCMP, which was used to quell Indigenous rebellion and to help to clear the land for white settlers in Canada. And only decades after the abolition of slavery, we can look to the heightened surveillance and policing of Black communities, to the high Black incarceration rates, to the segregation practices that were part a facet of Canadian life in many parts of the country, to the informal sundown laws that existed in many parts of the country as well. Today, anti-Blackness, the surveillance and punishment of Black peoples of all ages and genders, is embedded within all major state institutions. Contemporary practices of racial violence like carding, the war on drugs, the war on gangs, the treatment of poor Black families by social service agencies, the pulling apart and destruction of Black families by child welfare agencies. All of these practices across institutions point to one similarity, and that is the reality of anti-Black racism and anti-Black punishment that can be traced back to slavery. When we think about policing Black lives, we're often not talking about the realities of Black people with mental health issues and other disabilities across state institutions in Canada, whose lives are often treated as less valuable and more disposable. In a country that's so premised on the erasure of Blackness entirely, it should be no surprise that we've really also seen an erasure of Black resistance to state violence that spans back centuries as well. We can also look to the centuries of resistance of African Nova Scotian communities. And we can look more recently, for example, in the 1970s, to Black Jamaican domestic workers who are fighting racialized and gendered persecution by the state with attempted deportations. Policing Black lives comes out of a broader movement that is based not only in Canada, but in the United States, in the UK, in Brazil, and around the world that refuses to normalize or accept Black suffering and death at the hands of the state, and instead insists that all Black lives matter.
Next up, we have an interview with author Tayari Jones about her new book, An American Marriage, which is getting a lot of great press coverage. And Oprah Winfrey has added the book to her book club, and she has said, "It's among Tayari's many gifts that she can touch us soul to soul with her words." So I'll give you, give our listeners a little rundown of what the book is about, and then we'll play an interview from PBS NewsHour with the author Tayari Jones. And the book is called An American Marriage. Newlyweds Celestial and Roy are the embodiment of both the American dream and the New South. He is a young executive and she is an artist on the brink of an exciting career. They are settling into the routine of their life together when they are ripped apart by circumstances neither could have imagined. Roy is arrested and sentenced to 12 years for a crime Celestial knows he didn't commit. Though fiercely independent, Celestial finds her bereft and unmoored, taking comfort in Andre, her childhood friend, and best man at their wedding. As Roy's time in prison passes, she's unable to hold on to the love that has been her center. After 5 years, Roy's conviction is suddenly overturned, and he returns to Atlanta, ready to resume their life together. This stirring love story is a deeply insightful look into the hearts and minds of three people who are at once bound and separated by forces beyond their control. An American Marriage is a masterpiece of storytelling, an intimate look into the souls of people who must reckon with the past while moving forward with hope and pain into the future.
Now, Jeffrey Brown discovers the next item on the NewsHour bookshelf. Author Tayari Jones talks about her latest work.
Two people come together, get married, and then see their lives torn apart when the husband is falsely accused and convicted of a crime. A new novel explores the bonds of love and marriage in extreme circumstances against a larger background of race and mass incarceration. It's called An American Marriage. Author Tayari Jones joins me now. Welcome to you.
Thank you.
Is it correct that this began for you with thinking about the issue of mass incarceration?
It did. I was on fellowship at the Radcliffe Institute at Harvard, and I was doing research on mass incarceration. And I did so much research. I learned so many disturbing things. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I'm not an ethnographer. I'm not a sociologist. I'm a novelist.
Yeah.
And I had nothing to show for my time. The deadline was ticking for the presentation, and I had not written one fictional word.
Yeah.
But I went to Atlanta to visit my mother, and we went to the mall. And while I was at the mall, I overheard a couple arguing. And I heard the woman say, "Roy, you know you would not have waited on me for 7 years." And with that, my imagination just went wild with imagining the conflict between these two people.
Yeah. So you created your fictional Roy, who's the character, and Celestial, his wife. He gets sent off to prison, and then it becomes what happens, right? How do people behave under stress? What do two people owe each other?
Yes, how do you balance your desires and your responsibilities? I mean, Celestial, she's about 25 when he's arrested, and they've only been married 18 months.
Mm-hmm.
Her daddy is still paying for the wedding when he is taken away. Can we really expect her to basically live her life for him? how could you ask that of her? But then there's a feeling like, how could she not? And that, I think, is the conflict of the story.
You wrote this with alternating voices through letters that they sent to each other. But this was to give the two voices of a marriage? What?
The letters, for sure, because I'm a letter writer in real life. Yeah. I write 5 or 6 letters a week.
Actual letters?
Yes. And nobody writes me back. It's terrible. But I love the idea of them being in, with him in prison. The letters, yeah, just this literal small canvas, is all they have to try to be husband and wife with. You can just see how it's a losing battle. But I did want both their voices, because with him being in prison and her being in the world, they inhabit two different worlds. Neither of them is able to tell the full story.
There's a heartbreaking moment in the exchange of letters where the stress of imprisonment is so profound. And he writes to her, dear, one sentence, "Dear Celestial, I am innocent." And she, yes, writes back and says, "Dear Roy, I am innocent too."
Yes, because it's true. She is innocent. His innocence feels more elevated because he has been jailed for a crime he didn't commit. But she also, as his wife, is being jailed for a crime she didn't commit either. And they really have to figure out, will they remain married while he's in prison? And if they do, what does that mean to be married to someone you cannot touch?
Race is a constant here, along with incarceration, but also the questioning of growing up in a kind of well-to-do black Atlanta. And I read that this is your own upbringing. What were you trying to bring out?
Well, I do think that modern Southern life for black people is really underrepresented, right? Yeah. People think of the South as shorthand for black misery.
Yeah.
But, you know, I grew up in Atlanta, where there's this really robust black middle class, where I needed a doctor, and my godmother was reluctant to send me to the doctor because the doctor had not gone to Morehouse College. Mm-hmm. The doctor had gone to Harvard. But she says, "But I think he'll be okay for your cold." So Atlanta, for me, is that kind of place where it's kind of a black oasis. But and Celestial and Roy, I think, forget about the circumstances in the rest of the world, the rest of the country. And they go visit his family in the small town where he's from, and he is, as Celestial father says, the wrong race at the wrong time.
But you clearly wanted to put the African American sort of at the front of the story.
Yes, I mean, that is really the question of progress. What does it mean to be an individual? What is your responsibility to the collective? How is this amplified by race? Is it fair? Is fair beside the point? So these are the kind of hard, I think, very modern questions. I think it's a very modern moment for a black character to have to wonder whether or not the problems of one are the problems of all.
And I have to ask you, the title, An American Marriage, that's a big title, right? I mean, that puts sort of ups the stakes.
I was reluctant to take it for two reasons. For one, I had never really thought of myself as American without saying black American or African American. I told my editor that I felt like An American Marriage sounded like a novel about white people in Connecticut. And he says, Connecticut is a very small state. Why would you think what happens in that small state was somehow more representative of America than what happens in Atlanta, one of the largest cities in the country? And so I had to really think it over. And then he asked me another question. He says, if you feel that this title does not represent your work, I will support you in changing it. But if you're afraid of stepping into the world of big ideas, if you're afraid that your novel cannot support the weight of the claim of An American Story, he says, I really implore you to rethink it. And I said to him, I'll tell you tomorrow. And then I just thought about it, and I just decided to be brave.
You did, and you stepped into big ideas.
Yes.
Okay, the title is An American Marriage. Tayari Jones, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
That was an interview with PBS NewsHour with the author Tayari Jones of the new novel, An American Marriage. Up next, I have another news piece. This comes to us from the English Palestinian News Network. So this is for the theme today of International Women's Day. And they report, the Palestinian News Network in Bethlehem reports that more than 15,000 Palestinian women have been arrested by Israel since 1967. The Israeli authorities have arrested more than 15,000 Palestinian women since the beginning of the occupation of the West Bank, the Gaza Strip, and Jerusalem in 1967, official statistics revealed on Wednesday. A report compiled by Abdel Nasser Fawene, the PLO's Committee for Prisoners and Freed Prisoners Affairs, accused the Israeli occupation of escalating attacks against women over the past few years. He revealed that the Israelis have arrested 445 Palestinian women since the start of the Jerusalem Intifada in October 2015, including a number of girls, notably Ahed Tamimi, who right now remains in military detention. Farwana added that dozens of the women were shot and wounded by the Israeli occupation forces before their arrest. Fateme Takata, 15, for example, was shot, wounded, and arrested before being pronounced dead in March last year whilst in detention. On most occasions, women are arrested from their homes at the dead of the night, explained Farwana, and they are beaten and subjected to harsh treatment and exposed to physical and psychological torture while under arrest. What's more, he pointed out, Palestinian women inside Israeli jails are frequently denied proper medical treatment and are incarcerated alongside criminals, regardless of their age or alleged wrongdoing. The latest Palestinian women to be arrested by the Israelis, Farwana noted, was Fateme Jarar, 20 years old, from the West Bank city of Jenin, who is a student at Al-Quds Open University. The PLO official called for all local, regional, and international human rights groups to put pressure on the Israeli occupation to release the Palestinian women, as well as to fund support projects to empower them after their release. At the moment, there are 63 Palestinian women and girls being held in Israeli jails, including 8 university graduates, 10 minors, 20 married mothers, and 3 who are under administrative detention with neither charge nor trial.
I ain't got no clothes, ain't got no toilet paper, I can't even blow my nose, I can't brush my hair, ain't got no soap, there's no running water, it's hell on low. Oh, I got the dry cell blues. Oh, I got the dry cell blues. It could be 3 days, it might be 10, sleeping on coal metal, no papers, no pens, on my hands and knees, talking through a crack, hoping and praying, please send me back. Oh, I got the dry cell blues. Oh, I got the dry cell blues. Oh, I can't even read the Bible, I can't use a phone, I gotta take 3 craps before they let me go. 23 hours locked up and all alone, my mind is pain, my soul cries no. Oh, I got the dry cell blues. Oh, I got the dry cell blues. Loss of privileges is no mail and no calls. Suspected of tobacco, it's enough to lock you down. There's no talking, no laughing, no crying here. No water, no toothbrush, no mattress, no clothes. In segregation, there's no day, there's no night. A baby-sized blanket, you just feel frostbite. Vulnerable and cold, 72 hours alone in the dark. That's 259,200 seconds alone in the dark. That's 15,552,000 milliseconds alone in the dark. That's 10 days all alone in the dark. That's 14,400 minutes alone in the dark. No talking, no laughing, no crying. No talking, no laughing, no crying. Oh,
That was another song by Faith Nolan here on Skeezy's Prison Radio Show. And we're nearing the end of our program, but first we wanted to leave you with a couple of local announcements for events in more or less in relation to the Week Against Police Brutality. Well, tomorrow, Friday, March 9th at 7 p.m. at Cooper Concordia, there's going to be a screening of The Gentleman Bank Robber. The Gentleman Bank Robber is a portrait of revolutionary Rita Bow Brown, who is a white working class butch from rural Oregon, who became known as the Gentleman Bank Robber in the 70s for combining her butch style of dress with a polite way of demanding funds from bank tellers. So the film moves between everyday moments with Bow in and around her home in Oakland, California, as well as historical retelling of the events of Bow's life through interviews and her collaborators. There's archival materials and rare social justice movement ephemera. The Gentleman Bank Robber weaves together personal and political perspectives on 20th century social movement histories, including queer liberation in the 60s, militant underground activity with the George Jackson Brigade in the 70s, revolutionary prison abolitionist group, and political prisoner support work in the 1980s, and prison activist work into the present day. Bow Brown is a model for how to lead a life of committed activism while maintaining a sense of humor and humanity. The event is Pay What You Can. All funds will go to support Bo's medical expenses because Bo was diagnosed with Lewy body dementia. And as of October, Bo's community is raising funds to support her in-home medical care. If you can't attend the screening but still wish to donate, the fund is called Bo Brown Forever Activist, Forever Survivor Fundraising Campaign. You can visit, you can try to find it online on youcaring.com. We'll also post it on our Twitter blog. So the event again is at Cooper Concordia. It's wheelchair accessible. And tomorrow also marks the start of the Week Against Police Brutality in Montreal. There is going to be a meeting at 5 p.m., so before the Bow Brown screening, at McGill in the McLennan Library Building, third floor, room HSSL. There's going to be a meeting with the purpose of forming a committee in response to the police targeting of men having sex with other men in local parks. The call out for the meeting is in French. It says, les opérations policières visant la communauté gay montréalaise ne sont pas chose du passé. Depuis 2008, la SPVM a lancé trois opérations visant à éradiquer l'indécence prenant place dans des lieux de rencontres homosexuelles reconnus. So using a variety of tactics, the police often dressed en civil. The SPVM conducted searches, and it's time that that there be a response. And so, again, that's happening tomorrow, 5 p.m. at McGill University. On the 12th, on Monday, so in addition to Andrea Ritchie and Robin Maynard speaking at noon, there's also an event at 5 p.m. at UCAM, and it's tied to the launch of a magazine called Movements in French. And so there is going to be a roundtable discussion with four authors, including Andrea Ritchie and Marie Veillette, Laurence Ingenito, and Geneviève Pagé. Next Wednesday, March 14th, at Cactus, there will be a discussion on fighting for space, how a group of drug users transformed one city's struggle with addiction. It's going to be a book launch and discussion with advocates, activists, and author Travis Lupik around drug user advocacy, harm reduction, gentrification, police brutality, prohibition, human rights, overdose deaths, social struggles, and the intersectionality of all of these struggles. So again, that's Wednesday, 5:30 at Cactus. And the Week Against Police Brutality here in Montreal, of course, culminates on March 15th with a rally and demonstration. The rally is going to begin at 5 p.m. at Parc La Fontaine with food and speeches near the corner of Garnier and Rachel. And then at 7:30, there is going to be a march in the annual demonstration against police brutality or against police. And this year they are going to be walking around the village.
The time is presently 5:59. You're listening to the Prison Radio Show on CKUT 93.FM, 91.7 on cable, and www.ckut.ca. We're getting close to the end of our show. Thanks for tuning in. Check out past episodes of the Prison Radio Show at prisonradioshow.wordpress.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at Prison Radio Show. The Prison Radio Show airs twice a month.